He still has a way to go before he can take the old man.
I don't doubt it, Scott said, chuckling. What confuses me, though, is how you all knew the president would be here in Switzerland.
That is information that I'm not on a need-to-know basis on. You have to ask your buddy Lawler at the FBI. He put this thing together from what I hear.
So if the president's gone, why are you still hanging around?
Scott, just because you're not on the ski team and don't live in Park City anymore, doesn't mean I don't still care about you.
You've gotten friendly with one of the nurses, haven't you?
Maybe.
John, some things never change.
As far as you're concerned, you were suffering from exhaustion and got beat up pretty good. They'll want to run some more tests here and at home, but I think you'll make it.
Thanks.
Don't mention it. Is there anything I can get for you?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Whoops, I forgot. I left something outside. Can you hold that thought for a second?
I guess, said Scott,
who watched as John jogged out of the room. A minute later, he heard the door open and John say, "Here we are." He entered, pushing Claudia in a wheelchair. Her face was bruised, and Scott could see that she had received some stitches to her swollen lip, but she was as beautiful as ever. Scott didn't even hear John say, "I'll leave you two alone," as he graciously slid out of the room. She stood and walked to the side of Scott's bed. Wordlessly, she reached out and took his hand. Scott pulled her to him, and as carefully as he could so as not to hurt her injured lip, he kissed her. Claudia wrapped her arms around him, holding him tightly. They both ignored their pain, happy it was all over, and that they were together.
81. Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, 0430, next day. Two pairs of white Mercury Villager minivans pulled into the driveways of the houses bordering Donald Fawcett's palatial estate. A fifth van waited out on Snake Drive, ready to apprehend any vehicles that might try to escape. At precisely the same moment, a Boston Whaler with quieted outboards was waiting for the go code to beach in front of Fawcett's home and assault the house from the lawn. Gary Lawler watched the seconds tick by on his watch. The team of heavily armed FBI HRT and support agents had practiced the raid over and over again until Lawler was confident they could do it in their sleep. Only then did he okay the actual assault. Based on what he had gleaned about Donald Fawcett and his involvement with the president's kidnapping, he didn't expect him to come willingly. Lawler had been provided with the details of a Swiss intelligence officer's confession, given from his hospital bed in Geneva. Despite the Chinese wall that served to hide who took the confession and how it was obtained, Lawler knew it had been done by the CIA. Supposedly, Gerhard Meiner had willingly provided the confession and named names in exchange for a reduction in the charges. Whether certain methods had been used to extract the confession was anybody's guess, but they probably had. Despite Lawler's leads and a quickly closing net on Donald Fawcett, the White House wanted a quick end to the situation and had agreed to the deal. Gerhard Meiner would probably show up somewhere with a bullet in the back of his head within a month anyway, just as long as whoever did it wasn't dumb enough to use one that said, "Made in the USA." The information delivered to Lawler also came with a special FYEO, for your eyes only. The reason Gerhard Meiner was in the hospital was because Scott Harvath had beaten the shit out of him, almost killed him with his bare hands. Lawler couldn't help but smile. He looked once again at his watch. 30 seconds. He told his teams to stand by. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go! 55 agents moved in from their assigned positions. All of the utilities were cut, and the security system disabled. Within a minute, agents had breached the front doors and were sweeping the house. There was no sign of Fawcett. A call came over the radio that agents clearing the study had found two bodies. Lawler got to their position as soon as he could. What he saw turned his stomach, even after all these years. The bodies of two men, shot execution style, lay in a pool of congealing blood on the hardwood floor.
Retrieving their wallets and seeing their names on their IDs made him even sicker. The bodies appeared to be those of Senators Russell Rolander and David Snyder. After a thorough search of the property, Donald Fawcett was still nowhere to be found.
82. Washington, D.C., 1 week later.
After 5 days in the Swiss hospital, Harvath was flown home to the United States, ostensibly to recuperate and undergo further tests. In reality, a whole host of people, including the Justice Department, the CIA, the FBI, and the Secret Service, wanted him back for debriefing. After a while, the questions grew to be monotonous and repetitive, but it was all part of the job. Director Jameson had an authorized agent transcribe Scott's debriefing, and only asked him to read it over and sign it if it was correct. Mercifully, Scott had no typing to do. He attended a private ceremony at the White House after the funeral of the vice president. The story in the press was that the cause of death had been injuries suffered in a freak accident at home, while in reality, Marshfield had finally cracked under the pressure of what he had done. Knowing he would soon be caught, he'd realized he couldn't face the music and took his own life. Harvath was shown into the Oval Office and was soon joined by the President, who was accompanied by the Attorney General, Gary Lawler, and Secret Service Director Jameson. Scott stood as they entered.
"Here is the man I've been waiting to see," said the President, as he strode across the blue carpeting.
Seeing the President's right arm in a sling, Harvath immediately offered his left hand. The President grasped it warmly.
"I cannot thank you enough," the President said. "Once the full story of what you went through was relayed to me, I couldn't believe it. You risked everything."
"That's my job, sir," said Harvath.
"Well, I don't know how to repay you."
"It's not necessary, sir."
"Sir, may I interrupt?" broke in the Attorney General.
"Of course. I know your time is limited, and I also know you requested that this meeting with Agent Harvath function as a wrap-up."
"A wrap-up?"
asked Scott.
Director Jameson cleared his throat. "Kind of a final debriefing. We know the overall facts are a bit fuzzy for you, and the President felt you had earned the right to the full story."
"I see," said Scott.
"Why don't we all take a seat?" said the President.
The guests divided themselves among the couches and assembled chairs.
"Since Deputy Director Lawler was responsible for such a large part of the investigation," said the Attorney General, "I think he should be the one to fill you in. Agent Lawler?"
"Thank you, Attorney General."
"Agent Harvath, Scott, on behalf of all of us, I would like to apologize for the way in which we treated you," Lawler said.
"That's not necessary," said Scott.
"No," continued Lawler, "it is. Your instincts were right on the money, every step of the way. It's because of you that we have the President back in one piece."
"Well, maybe not exactly one piece," the President said, holding up his sling.
Everyone in the room laughed politely. Lawler waited for the laughter to die down before continuing.
"To a certain degree, the real linchpin was the wine invoice you sent me. The vin de Constance that Miner had cellared at the Hotel de Balance was actually paid for by Donald Fawcett."
"The industrialist?"
Scott was amazed. Yet another twist.
"What does he have to do with all of this?"
"The President had put together, and you will excuse me for saying so, sir, a rather shaky coalition to pass a new piece of legislation. It is an alternative energy bill that would cut our dependence upon fossil fuels dramatically over the next 20 years. Do you know how Fawcett Industries makes most of their money?"
"Let me guess. It has something to do with fossil fuels?" asked Scott.
"Right. Their mining, extraction, refinement, distribution, and sale, to be exact. His commercial empire is based on it. Even passage of part of the President's bill would have cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. If the act passed in full, it would cost billions."
The President broke in. "There were strong lobbying efforts for and against this bill. There were a lot of jobs and related issues at stake. It's no secret that I'm not seeking another term. This bill was going to be my legacy, and I was bound and determined to get it passed.
As Deputy Director Lawler noted, and no offense taken, by the way, the coalition of votes I had established was shaky at best. Without me there to cajole and handhold, the whole thing would have fallen apart.
So, if I may, asked Scott.
Certainly, replied the president.
Fawcett's goal was to get you out of the picture long enough to have the bill stall and fall apart.
The deputy director is the best one to fill in all the details. Thank you, Mr. President. Apparently, that was the plan, said Lawler. But it went bad. I'll remind you, Scott, that nothing we talk about can ever leave this room.
Yes, sir, I understand completely.
Stargazer turned out to be the vice president.
Vice President Marshfield?
Scott was sickened by it, but not completely surprised. Yes. Unfortunately, the vice president, being of weak character, was drawn into this mess along with Senators Snyder and Rolander.
What was in it for them?
It was the same across the board for all of them. Money. Rolander and Fawcett had been pals since their college days, and I think Rolander had always been envious of Fawcett's wealth. Rolander got in his pocket early on, and then at some point in this process, when and how we may never know, he brought Snyder in. They wooed Vice President Marshfield with promises of a huge campaign war chest filled with untraceable contributions.
And, said Scott, with the president not running for re-election next year, this scenario gave Marshfield a chance to get out in front of the cameras and show American voters how he could operate in a tough situation.
That's right. The thing he wasn't expecting was for the situation to get tougher. From what we've been able to uncover, the deal had been that the kidnappers would hold on to the president long enough for the bill to collapse, and then he would be sent home.
So the FRC angle was just a front all along, wasn't it?
Exactly. The kidnappers knew Marshfield would never authorize the release of the Disneyland bombers, nor would he put any pressure on any other countries like Egypt to release any funds or other prisoners the kidnappers might ask for. It was all one big ruse.
Just like the president's cell in Switzerland. When he was returned home and debriefed, everything he would describe would be consistent with having been kidnapped by the Fatah, right down to the lousy smells, desert heat, and calls for worship.
That was the plan. But then the kidnappers got greedy. They already had the president. Why not demand more money? Fawcett didn't care what happened, so he wasn't going to pay up. He'd already paid them enough, and even if they did kill the president, Marshfield would take his place, and Fawcett would own the new president lock, stock, and two smoking barrels. When the kidnappers turned their sights on Marshfield for more money, that's when he began to fall apart.
How did Bill Shaw fit into all of this?
Marshfield recruited him. Shaw had been involved in a couple of small things he shouldn't have been. He was helping to rig security contracts for old friends, and when Senator Snyder gave this information to the vice president, it was pretty easy bringing Shaw on board. He was offered money and a good chance at the directorship of the Secret Service once Marshfield took office.
But you didn't put all this together from the wine invoice, did you? Asked Tarvath.
No. A lot of this was the result of Miners and Shaw's confessions. The wine invoice led us to Fawcett, which led us to the refinery fire in Magna, Utah, just outside of Salt Lake. When we realized the president had been kidnapped, we checked and triple-checked every flight that left the Salt Lake area. There had been a Medijet flight supposedly repatriating one of Fawcett's British chemists, terribly burned in the fire back home in England, to die. The problem was, the deeper we looked into it, the harder the chemist was to find. He was a ghost. He never existed. We got a hold of the plane and had our forensics people go over it for everything. The Medijet people said that because of an oxygen tent that was needed to transport the terribly burned patient, the patient used his own stretcher. We found small pieces of mud that must have been on the wheels of the stretcher that matched the mud from the farm where the Mormon couple had been murdered.
Scott remembered how badly Lawler had chewed him out at that farm and let it pass. That was behind them now. So the farm was a staging ground, and they loaded the president into an ambulance there and simulated the burns before leaving on the Medijet flight?
Yes, and all of this has been confirmed in Gerhard Miner's confession. That's why I needed you to let him live, Scott, said the president. We needed to know who was behind all this.
So, what now? I understand Fawcett is still at large, said Scott.
With his kind of money, it's easy to disappear, said Lawler. But we'll find him. We already have a couple of leads. By the way, I have a message for you from my boss, FBI Director Source.
Scott's eyebrows raised.
He was needed at the office and was sorry he couldn't be here to give it to you in person. You can imagine how busy all of us still are.
Of course I can.
Director Source wanted me to tell you how proud he is of you. He says you are a credit to the Secret Service and to your country.
Hear, hear, said Director Jameson.
Secondly, he knew the tremendous burden you felt losing so many men. He wants you to know his thoughts are with you.
That's very kind of him. Please tell him I said thank you.
But that's not all.
No?
No. He is very aware of how William Shaw betrayed you and the rest of the Secret Service. He wants you to know that Shaw will be standing trial and that he apparently slipped several times as agents took him into custody. The director knew you would appreciate this last bit of information. Scott looked at the president and the attorney general, who acted as if they didn't comprehend the reference, and then let a small smile creep across his lips.
Thank you.
You're welcome, said Lawler. So, that's about it. Any questions?
I have one for the president.
Go ahead, he said.
How's Amanda?
She's wonderful, and is mending quite well. That's another thanks I owe you. You saved my daughter's life.
I'm just glad she's going to be okay.
If you have time after this meeting, she's recuperating in the residence and would love to see you.
That would be nice. I'll make sure I stop by.
Director Jameson, I believe you have something else to say, said the president.
Yes, sir.
Scott, the Secret Service is extremely proud of you. We know what has happened over the last almost 2 weeks has not been easy for you at all. It also goes without saying that you have been cleared of all allegations of wrongdoing, and we apologize that you were ever placed in this situation to begin with. We know you'll probably need a little more time off for R&R, but the president has authorized me to offer you the position of Chief of White House Security. We have a lot of rebuilding to do, and none of us can think of a better man to do it.
I don't know what to say.
Say yes, said Lawler. And the room broke out in another polite round of laughter.
Yes, I'll take it.
Everyone in the room stood and applauded, and Scott rose to shake their hands.
Before you go, said the president, as a hush fell over the room, I would like to ask you, Agent Harvath, if there's anything else I can do. You saved my life and my daughter's. I've given you a new job, but that's hardly enough. If there's anything else I can do for you, say the word, and it's yours.
Well, Mr. President, there is one thing.
Epilogue. Caspian Sea, 1 month later.
Darling, if you don't hurry, you will miss sunset, drawled the beautiful blonde woman in her thick Russian accent.
Her tan body was a stark contrast to the white cotton hammock in which she lay. Their sleek sailing yacht sat peacefully at anchor off the Russian coast, with only an occasional ripple across the warm, dark water to disturb yet another otherwise perfect day.
"Darling, are you bringing drinks?"
she said in that voice that had captivated him when he first met her in Minsk.
"Da! A little more tequila, and I'm going to show you the best margarita you've ever had. Even the fucking Mexicans don't make them this good," shouted a man's voice from below deck.
"Well, hurry. Light is going."
Yeah. Keep your perestroikas on. If you knew how to do anything else but lie around, I'd be up there enjoying it instead of down here.
From the quiet water, 8 wetsuited men with rebreathers broke the surface. 4 swam forward to the bow of the vessel, while the remaining men boarded from the stern. With his MP5 at the ready, Scott Harvath crept quietly into the bowels of the yacht and searched for his target. As he rounded on the galley, he could hear the sound of a blender working on crushed ice. 10 feet away,
His target was dressed in Madras Bermudas and a white linen shirt. Harvath conspicuously cleared his throat, and Donald Fawcett spun to see the MP5 pointed right at his forehead.
"Who the fuck are you? What do you want on my boat? I paid some pretty big people a lot of money for protection. If you don't want to have the Russian mafia crawling up your ass, I suggest you turn around and get off my yacht immediately," said Fawcett, incredulous even in the face of death.
"I'm operating on a little higher authority than the Russian mob," said Harvath.
Fawcett hadn't expected to hear English. Whoever this was, he was American, and that could mean only one thing.
"I have a special delivery for you from the president," Harvath continued.
He lowered his weapon, took aim, and shot the finger of Fawcett's right hand that still rested on the blender's pulse button. The blender exploded, sending margarita mix all over the galley as Fawcett reeled back in pain. He staggered and moved backward toward a row of drawers. Shock and disbelief were written across his face as he clutched his bleeding hand.
"You have no authority here. These are Russian waters," cried Fawcett. "There's no extradition deal here. You can't just come and take me."
Fawcett let go of his bleeding hand and reached for something behind him.
"You see, that's where we have a problem due to lack of communication. I didn't come to take you back," said Harvath.
He saw the fear in Fawcett's eyes quickly turn to hate as he pulled a gun from behind his back and pointed it at Harvath. Reflexively, Scott squeezed the trigger and sent a volley of bullets into Fawcett's head. Before the lifeless body had slid to the floor, Scott engaged the throat mic beneath his wetsuit and spoke the four words he knew the president, Gary Lawler, and everyone else watching and listening in the White House Situation Room were waiting to hear.
"Tango down. Mission accomplished."
He then disengaged the microphone and said into the quiet space,
"That was for you, Sam. I'll miss you."
Harvath looked at his watch and figured he would be able to make the morning flight to Zurich. He knew Claudia would be more than happy to pick him up. It was finally time for that vacation.
Lions of Lucerne was written by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz. Editing by Rob Weisberg with post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Louisa Solomon. The Lions of Lucerne was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Lions of Lucerne is available from Pocket Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Blacklist and Full Black, both by Brad Thor, read by Armin Schultz.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.